Hey guys, welcome to the Getting Back Into Place podcast. In this episode, I spoke with Los Angeles-based architect and educator Aaron Gensler. In our conversation, we talk about the evolution of architectural academia, different ways to be an effective educator, and several topics surrounding architecture school, including studio culture, all-nighters, the creative process, and final review juries. Aaron is an associate professor and the chair of undergraduate and graduate architecture programs at Woodbury University in Los Angeles. She serves on the National Council for Madam Architect and is a member of the Board of Trustees for California College of the Arts. Aaron is one half of Gensler Clip, an architecture design and research practice based in Southern California. And prior to forming Gensler Clip, she held design positions at a diverse array of firms from Los Angeles to Rwanda. She received her Master of Architecture from Cornell University and holds a Bachelor of Arts from Middlebury College. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Aaron Gensler. But how do you feel about the end of the semester? I know that you're on you said you're on the final day. How do you feel about everything?
Yeah, I mean, it's been really wonderful to be back in person, to get to sort of experience the community again, because I think architecture is really built through a bunch of people. And so having some student, a little bit of last semester was online, and we had some hybrid students. So some students were still online. And, you know, I think that really creates this dual way of learning and teaching. And so it's been awesome to have everybody back in person because, you know, it's a community and everyone's learning and helping from each other. There's obviously growing pains of the new world post COVID. And I think, I mean, we'll get into this later, but I think like the architectural education in our country and the world is at a point of like intense change.
Well, what do you, I mean, we can get into it now. There's no reason why we can't. Yeah. what do you think's changing? Like how do you see this evolution?
Yeah, I'm really excited about the future of architecture education. I think for so long it's been a really insular community, and I think in many ways destructive to the people who practice architecture. And so I think there's a new generation of thinkers, practitioners, idea generators, students who are asking us to be better. And that's really exciting. I think also opening up the profession to more people makes more interesting worlds. And if we're world builders, then bringing new voices to this community is imperative. Architecture is inherently a reflection of society. And so if we limit who gets to make those choices to a certain type of person, then we're limited in the worlds we create. There's like some growing pains. I think we've seen it in sort of backlash against ways of practicing and ways of educating. And there's a new generation of educators ready to take up that challenge. And I feel really privileged to get to work with a lot of them. And for us to really assess where we are as a community, are we really serving the populations that we should be? Are we really creating the spaces that we need to make? It's not only architecture as a practice is changing rapidly, but the world is. And so we need to be agile. We need to figure out where we're going.
I'm sort of interested in, because I knew we were going to talk about this, as I know you did too. And I was interested in perhaps us trying to, or even you might have the answer already, trying to define what it is that we are evolving from. Like, what are the kind of components or characteristics of, I guess we could call it, let's just say for the sake of our conversation, we'll say of traditional architectural education. We have things like the all-nighter and like the expectation of long hours, things like that. And for me, I'm always living in the paradox, as you know. And so I think what we're not saying is like, oh no, don't work hard on your craft. Don't apply yourself. But I think there's something about the expectation of you should be here. I know there's a lot to be said about the format of the jury and the nature and dynamics of the jury, but what kind of attributes have to do in this kind of traditional form of architectural education?
Yeah, I think there's a few conversations to be had. This sort of breaks down into different moments in the architecture education. I think if you kind of pull back and look at it as what architecture school is for, I think previously it's been really about gatekeeping. Like if you can come into this world of creators, world builders, if you do these things, if you go through this like painful growth into this beautiful butterfly, like I think then, and I think at least from my perspective, and I should say that my perspective is not everybody's perspective, and I'm really privileged to be able to talk to you about this today, but I think there's a lot of amazing educators and thinkers who are grappling with different ways this is in play. But for me, it's really about opening up the profession and opening up anybody who wants to work hard to get there. I never think it's not hard work, but and I think there's a danger in saying like, you can never do an all-nighter. You can never do anything. Like, I think you need to find the drive within yourself. You need to figure out how to manage your time, how to prioritize, how to create hierarchies of what's important to communicate. Because this is, and I think something that you and I talk about sometimes, this is a industry about making ideas real. And so how do you get the tools that you need to create a place, to get back into place?
I like how you're putting it. You're wanting to open it up to more people. And I mean, what do you think historically has closed architecture off to people?
I mean, I think one of the, I think in some of the previous conversations you've had, people have shared that there's not often many people of color or women, and I think it's not just in the industry at large, but it's in design roles, it's in leadership roles, and the inequality between the people who are making the decisions and the people who are affected by them. And as we like question a lot of, I think even before the pandemic, we were beginning to question everything we know as status quo. And so the pandemic also shook things up a lot and allowed us to look inward and understand what our industry looks like. How do we support each other? How do we support the communities that we're in? And as we develop a new pedagogy, not only access, but in financial access, and which is huge because economics are a huge driver of how you build things, but also about education in America right now. And so one of the things that I'm really proud that we do is partner with amazing educators in community colleges. So you don't have to necessarily take the massive leap into architecture. You can try it and you can prepare and get some general education out of the way, because architecture education is long and tedious, and it can be really expensive. Finding different pathways through gaining an education and then going into licensure. And one of the things that we have in our program is the IPAL program, which helps students graduate with a license or on the way towards one. So IPAL, for the people listening.
What does that stand for those who don't know that?
IPAL stands for the Integrated Path to Architectural Licensure. Especially as we jump into more of a global economy, architects graduate from Spanish institutions with a license. Are we able to do that? What is our education doing? And I think educational systems across the world are really different. And you know, I was able to lecture at the AA, and we have incredible students who are coming with backgrounds from, I was just on a review this morning for a visualization class who sent their models or these like user interfaces for a Grasshopper plugin to students in Thailand and India. And so I think to think about this also as a, I'm not sure if I'm phrasing this right, but I think how do we use our best assets as a larger community, right, and open it up so that those can help us solve problems that we don't even know exist yet?
Yeah, IPAL is an interesting program. I guess it's fair to call it a program, because I think it addresses at least a question that I have, and I wanted to ask you, of what is the role of architecture school, right? Like, I think this is not like an old, I don't want to say it's a debate, but this is not an old discussion where I think you and I both have talked to professionals who are like, oh, you know, these kids are coming out of school and they can't do X, Y, Z. And, you know, why are they not learning that? You know, maybe do a code analysis or something, or whatever it may be. And I actually think you do learn those kinds of things too, in a very, I'll say superficial. I don't mean in a negative way, but you learn some of those things in a very superficial way in school. It's something that I don't think can realistically be learned without practicing professionally. Like, you have to do a lot of code analysis and have someone more experienced check it and correct it. And I think that's how we work. And I think that's something that the IPAL program captures, because my understanding, and definitely correct me if I'm wrong, is that students do have a year where there is no class and it's full time in a firm.
Yeah. I mean, our program, IPAL, can exist in many different ways, and within the different schools who are part of the program, some have it throughout their curriculum. Some have it like go forth and do your own thing, but make sure you get the hours. And okay. But I think maybe we should backtrack a little bit and just talk about architectural licensure. Like, mm-hmm. I think I listened to the other incredible speakers. I have really enjoyed this podcast, but I think I might be the first licensed architect on the podcast.
I think so. Yeah.
And yeah. I think it's a contentious thing. I think you can talk to architects and designers, and each person has their own sort of pathway through the profession. It's a really vast career. There are project managers, there are really technical designers, there are visionaries, there's so many ways to fit into this profession that I think architecture school hopefully gives you a little taste test of like different ways of thinking and doing. Nice. It's like a poo-poo platter of what architecture can right, be. Right. But also it starts to highlight the responsibilities we have as architects and designers. And I think you talked about like the ethics of architecture. And one of the things that we do is health, self, safety, and welfare of the public. And there's skills that you need to accomplish for that. Like, I think you need to really think, like, one of my favorite ways of teaching egress is true crime. My podcast world is mostly true crime. And so when you talk about how if you don't create a good egress plan, people will die. You know, I think if you don't understand and have an understanding of structure, people will die. I don't mean to be like, dum, dum, dum. This is like, because there's so much of like concept, but hopefully throughout your curriculum and the way you learn, you're adding new skills and new ideas. One of the things that I really love about our faculty is there's so many different ways of thinking about architecture, and you get a little taster throughout your 10 semesters if you're an undergrad here. And hopefully that allows you to sort of figure out where you fit into the spectrum of architecture. And as you gain more knowledge and practice, and I think, like, you know, the specific code analysis, like, you'll get into that. You'll learn how to do it. But I think sort of finding partners in practice who are willing to also mentor and support our young designers is imperative, because we can't just be creating people who are good at doing drawings or models. We want to also be thinking about how do we create thoughtful practitioners ready to engage with the future of what this profession can be and should be. I hope our alumni, and I'm really proud to say I think they are ones who are leading a lot of the conversations in practice right now.
Yeah, I like that. And I like that you bring up licensure. Is it seems that the kind of the NAB accredited degree, the whole point is to become the one path really that is shaping the coursework is to become a licensed architect. Because I'm thinking like the person who, or have you been thinking about how to speak to a student who may be interested in the built environment, but maybe who does not want to go be an architect in an architecture firm? You know, are there people who don't want to do that path that could go to architecture school and have a path for themselves?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think licensure is a really valuable thing because especially, I mean, in my experience as a woman in the practice, and maybe I sound very bold in this when you're listening to my voice, but I think I have a pretty soft voice generally. I was often not taken, I think, as seriously on a job site because I didn't have a license. And so for me, it was important for me after I graduated to get licensed because it gave a little bit more weight to who I was in the room. And I think no matter what your opinions are on licensure, it's also important to the outside world. One of the ways of opening up architecture is in the languages that we use, but architect as a term is really defined by having licensure in the state that you're practicing. But I think architecture education is one of the best things you can ever do for yourself. Like, it's such a good investment in your brain, your problem solving. Like, Sean, you went to architecture school. You're not working on drawings right now, I assume.
No, I'm not. I hear you. I hear you. Well, one quick little anecdote, to your point about being a woman with the kind of power or impact of the architecture license. So pretty much when I worked, I think it was for about 3 or 4 years when I was going up on the traditional path of, to get licensed, and I was trying to do my exams and studying. I did all my AXP hours and all that whole thing. Pretty much all of my mentors were women, and and on more than one occasion, I remember going on a construction site and the contractors being like, "Oh, the architect's here," and coming straight toward me to talk to me. And I would all, and I mean, I'm visibly just, you know, young man, much younger. And I'm just like, "No, this is the architect." And it was obviously the my mentor who was a woman, and some of them I would have conversations, and like, that's not an uncommon thing. And they had been there before talking to the contractor. But if like somehow when I showed up, they just came to me instead of who the point person's been the whole time. But I don't know. It just made me think of that. I wanted to share that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think also it's maybe confusing because I have a boy's name. The way my name's spelled, Aaron, is like A-A-R-O-N. I was named after my mom's father who passed away before I was born, and it's been complicated growing up. Put in a boy's dorm for a moment in college, like, but I think there is like a weight that comes with licensure. It's a lot of work to get licensed in architecture, but it opens up a lot of possibilities. And when I talk to students about like maybe changing majors or, you know, taking a break, I think one of the things that we often talk about is like, how do we create the most possibilities for you in the future? How do you open up pathways that you might not even know exist yet? Because architecture teaches you how to problem solve. It teaches you how to communicate ideas. It teaches you how to work as a team, how to learn from other people. We're in a world of like exponential change. And it also teaches you how to learn. Oftentimes students are like, why don't we have more technical classes? But I think what's the most valuable thing that anybody could really do with it upper education is like get curious and keep going. Because the things that I was taught in school, especially in technology, have changed completely. And so how do you engage with a world that's changing, but keep sort of the concepts that last beyond a different type of technology? Like, we talk about these I don't know if you've seen all of this Midjourney AI stuff that's like everywhere, and everybody's Instagram has like a beautiful
AI portrait
or something. But I think like there's going to be continued conversations about authorship in design as we move forward. And one of the things I think is so incredible about what you learn in architecture school is how to listen, how to reflect, but also how to curate and find problems that maybe technology would not have agency to find yet or to question.
Yeah. I'm curious how you as chair of undergraduate and graduate programs or architecture at Woodbury, how you're thinking about educating the student body. Because you've been in this role for, is it two years now?
A year and a month, I think.
A year.
Okay. It might feel like two years.
yeah. So for a year, what have you been trying to accomplish during this time? I mean, I know in the beginning it was just trying to keep your head above water. There's a lot to do. But how are you thinking about the pedagogy in the school, about what the students should be walking away with? I'm curious. Yeah, I'm curious where you're at with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think often we talk to people in practice, and they want us to deliver somebody who's ready to like jump in and do Revit drawings or digital drawings. And I think that's awesome. We should prepare students for the skills they need to be successful when they get out. I think our student body, there's a lot of opportunity for them to have like well-paying careers. And I know we talk often about how this profession doesn't pay enough, and that's another way to go down, another like wormhole to go down. But I think it's really important that students are able to get a well-paying job when they graduate. But I also think that's really short-sighted. I think there needs to be more. We've introduced some new classes. Our curriculum is divided into knowledge tracks, building, which really focuses on sort of the technical components, structure, systems, how we communicate with allied professions, and then we also have professional practice, which has multiple instances about how do we reflect the... How do we position ourselves within practice? And then we have criticism, which looks at the history and sort of how do you place yourself within a larger scope of the architectural world and everything that's come before us, which is a lot. And then that all comes together in studio. But we've added a few new classes, both in building and in professional practice. The professional practice class that we've added is really about looking at our industry and looking at how to build something that makes it that looks, reflects it and in a critical way, in an optimistic way, and how do you move forward so that our students will be really capable of putting a drawing together when they graduate, but then when they have the opportunity to lead a practice or participate in leadership at a larger firm, they're ready to understand the weight that comes with.
I see. Okay.
And then in the building track, we've added more because I think our technology in the built world is really shifting at a huge rate. And to get, like, we added an advanced materials and methods class, and I was just looking at the work from the other day and just getting students excited and curious about the small details of a project and the materials that we use and the tools that we have at our disposal. And I don't know if that really speaks to like where we're going with our pedagogy, but yeah. I think for me, it's less about exactly what type of architects we're going to create. Cause I really think like everybody who's coming here has a story and has something important to bring to the table. So I hope that we're not creating cookie cutter architects, that everybody brings a new perspective to the profession, and our profession is richer because of the graduates that we have here.
Yeah, I think, I agree with that. One of the things that I really appreciated about Woodbury was first that because the university as a whole is so small, and the School of Architecture, I do think, takes up a pretty large portion of the surface area of the campus.
Big part. The architecture department alone is almost like 40% of the university. So
yeah. But the access that I had to like the liberal arts school and the other disciplines within Woodbury and the, I'll say, intertwinedness that there seemed to be with the School of Architecture, I felt like it did allow me to go down rabbit holes that I felt like were relatively contrarian, or maybe they weren't even contrarian. There was just something that was cultivated within the school. And then you have other schools where there may be a kind of expected aesthetic, an expected kind of output, you know, and look that you're encouraged to kind of to have. And it sounds like what you're saying is like, how do we create, how do we provide resources that in the most optimum manner that allows a student to, you know, capitalize on whatever they're drawn to, whether what their inclinations are, while providing that kind of foundational competency. That's what I always tell students, that like they'll graduate and go into a firm, and obviously things are difficult. Like, you can never know everything from your time in school. And I always say architecture school taught you the alphabet and, like, you know, the phonetics of the language. And now you're starting to engage with sentences and paragraphs. And but if you didn't have the kind of foundational understanding of how the language worked, you wouldn't be able to even interact. You'd be kind of at a loss. And then there's some like reduction in how I'm describing that. But to some degree, I feel like architecture school provided the foundational skills for me, at least, to navigate in a way that allowed me to continue my growth and to understand some of what people were talking about to a certain degree, as I progress further. And then I could build on the skills I learned at school. And a lot of times I would even look back at what I discussed in school maybe 2 years later and actually understand it more now at that time than I did when I was in school.
Yeah. I mean, I think the way that you spoke about this as being a language, like, we first semester is one of my favorite things to teach in architecture and architecture studio, because you get to see this intense growth, this like students struggling to draw a line, building these like inhabitable spaces that deal with circulation and all of these and structure, and how do you make things balance, and how do you represent it, and how do you tell in the language that we speak visually and with our words, like, how does that inform, or how do you, yeah, it's the basics, and then you have so many possibilities in the words that you create or the buildings that you create after. And each semester you get a little bit more complexity and challenges, like in terms of like site analysis or housing or users or computational tools. And so this builds on itself, but I think it's really important to think that most people who are architects like learning, and that's for good reason, because every project we're on is going to be different. Each client is going to be different. It's in the DNA of the profession to continually push yourself to learn more. And there's no way that in even our education is longer than most, 5 years for a BArch. Even in that time, there's so much that you cannot cover. But I think there's a lot of interest in shifting the ways that this can be done. I'm really excited about working with industry partners more, and sort of instead of it being the academy and practice, how do we find ways to overlap? I know there's some really amazing programs besides IPEL that like embed students in practice. But I think one of the things I would instigate for anybody who's in practice listening is like, how do you get involved with these communities? There's incredible architecture colleges throughout the country, throughout the world. If you're an architect, please reach out. Like there's opportunities to sit on panels. There's students looking for mentors. There's a next generation that is so inspiring. Like I come to work and oftentimes I'll listen to like the news on my way and I'm in a terrible mood when I get to campus. And then I walk down to studio and see it's like a new thing that I had never expected. Like we have students working on the Solar Decathlon who are pushing like anything that I would feel comfortable doing, you know? And it's really incredible to see and gives me hope about where we're going.
You brought up these very novel inventions that you're happening upon in studio or when you come and see the students. And I want to talk a bit about studio culture because I think a lot of the things that we critique about studio culture are also a lot of the things that can be of value to studio culture, but also, and I'll be more specific in a second, but also I think, but because when I really do think back to like professors that I had that would push the class to be in studio, it really was just to capture exactly what you were describing, like being around each other, experimenting with things, doing iterations, prototyping, building, just being in studio for hours on end and talking with colleagues and doing, you know, God knows what, sometimes produces these like really interesting things. And I think historically we can even look at inventions that were created in laboratories or discoveries that were made by accident from people just tinkering. What do you think can be as good about the traditional notion of studio, which is essentially, I mean, being there all the time? Like, you know, I'm curious what you think is good about that and what you think is, you know, perhaps we could say not good. I was going to say destructive, but I think this is kind of loading it too much. Yeah. What are your thoughts on studio culture and some of that?
Yeah. The good, bad, and ugly of studio culture. I'll just start with like a personal story. Okay. For me, I, in grad school, had convinced myself that 2 a.m. was my magic hour. That's when all of the good stuff happened. That's when, like, stuff got weird, and I was like, genius. And then I woke up in the morning, and I was like, I mean, it's fine, but it's, like, definitely, I mean, maybe it was less waking up in the morning, waking up from a nap. And, like, I think now that I have, like, evolved as a person, I think that was really naive to think, you know. I think I really function well with a full night's sleep and on a schedule. I think I had such amazing colleagues in architecture school that I still talk to, but a lot of it was because the person I would call at 3 a.m. are probably the people I'll still call to ask questions about a detail. And that community goes with you. Architecture is a pretty small, like, even after you're out of school, it's a pretty small world. Our community is important, but it is very tight. And so the people you're with in studio are going to be around you for your lifetime if you're still in the profession.
Yeah.
But I think that we've convinced ourselves and each other that that's the way that it has to be. And I think the pandemic has really illustrated there are other ways of doing things. And now we're in a sort of a time where we're learning what we lost and what we want to come back. I think we're all kind of going through this together too, because there was like this huge global trauma that we just are slowly coming out from. And so on our campus, we're really trying to ask the students for their response and what's working and what isn't, because I don't think we have all the answers on how to make this still the space. One of the ideas that was floated by the administration was closing down studios at midnight. We have students who work 40 hours a week. We have students with kids, and the studio should be a productive, supportive space for people to work when they need it. It really, I think, creates an equitable space. And so I think as an architectural education community, we're still sort of figuring out what a healthy studio culture looks like. Yeah. But I think during the pandemic, we realized it's really easy to silo worlds on computer screens, and that sort of magic that happens when you see somebody who's working on a project that's nothing like yours, that like sparks some genius idea at 2 a.m. is really incredible. And so I think the students who work more in studio have to teach each other, have to learn from each other. But I think it's also really mature to know when you shouldn't be there, when you need to take a break, when you need to take a nap, when you need to pull back, when you need to go get something to eat. And I know I am kind of sidestepping your question about what's good and bad about studio culture. But I think also it goes back to also the way that we teach architecture, and is the studio imperative? I have feelings about this, but I think like it's really important for us to question all the things we take for granted, that architecture has to be taught through studio, that architecture is something that like torments you. There's all these expectations that have been set up for generations, and I'm not sure the answer yet. And luckily I get to work with incredible students and educators to help develop a new world of learning the alphabets of architecture.
Yeah. No, I think it's a great answer. And it's kind of, I mean, the question is kind of not a good question. But I think it's intended for it to kind of get us into talking about this, because I still believe that, and I've always been this type of person, that if I'm been up for whatever amount of hours, for just say a long time, and it's, you know, let's say it's your 2 a.m. that you said, and you know, I think as just a human being who has a certain amount of bandwidth and energy and ability after a certain amount of deprivation of sleep, my belief that I'm going to revolutionize my diagram at 2 a.m. is probably not accurate. But to your point too, about the fact of it, whether it's people working, whether it's people who like to just kind of mess around forever and hours until they really get to, like, I know a lot of people that just need to like kind of, they just need the goof off warm up time to, and for whatever reason, their workflow is okay. You know, it's 12 a.m. I'm really ready to do some awesome work now, and the work turns out awesome. Is that the most sustainable thing once you get into the professional world? I mean, probably not. But I think we have been alluding to the point that there is a certain looseness to school before you get into an actual job.
I think what really impacted me when I, like, what we're doing in school, like, trains our expectations for what we do in practice. And I think that's a huge amount of responsibility for us in the education side of architecture. What bad habits are we allowing to continue? We have an internship program. Students need to complete a certain amount of hours before they graduate. They have to be paid. Hopefully something that the students understand here is we think you are valuable, you have agency, you are worthy, and you're worth it. And so I think like by setting up a culture of like, I like stay up until forever, push yourself to your limits. Like, I think those are things that can be helpful for some students. I don't want to stop people who want to do that. But also realizing it's not, like, as you said, it's not something that can be translated into profession, and it shouldn't be. Like, I think there is, I think we talk about reviews and public critiques, and I think there's ways that criticism can be really productive. But I also think in many cases, and hopefully less so, there's like a hazing that happens in architecture school that I think is so detrimental to our practice. Like, we're paid for services. If you go out thinking your time is invaluable, it ruins our whole profession.
So I want to talk about the review and jury, but I want to make a note, and curious of if you have thoughts on it or not. But it'd be interesting if, because we have these professional practice classes, and then you said there was that new one, and teaching the students new things about professional practice. I wonder if there is a value in like really critiquing these kind of notions that we have. And I call it the mythology of architecture, like the folklore of architecture, of the fact that like, you should struggle. You should be here late because that produces X, Y, Z. Like those statements are kind of like not really based on anything. They're just kind of like sayings. They're kind of like ancient proverbs of they're really like ancient modernist proverbs within architecture. I don't know what it would be. I'd have to do a bit of research, but there has to be literature out there on like, you know, the optimum time of creativity, what state of mind, or like what kind of, you know, nutrition or amount of sleep or whatever produces the highest levels of flow or whatever. Perhaps could be a way to engage this whole notion of production or creativity or, you know, doing the work. And I can already think of a bunch of books. Like I'm thinking of like Thinking Fast and Slow. I'm thinking of, I mean, this one kind of promotes what we're not talking about, but it's helped me with writing. There's a book called The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. But the point I'm getting at is, I wonder if there is a way if there is a place in architectural education to really directly address how to do creative work and in the most optimum healthy way, and to essentially debunk this whole notion that you have to be, you know, the tortured, struggling, harried, crazy looking artist that's, you know, struggled for their craft, and only until you're that you're not a true artist. Yeah, I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that? Or
yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the danger in sort of making one way of people learning is that what I hope is that we're opening up the profession, that there's different ways you can learn architecture, that there's more flexibility, that you can have, like, so many of our students have like full-time jobs while they're in architecture school, and I can't imagine what that's like, but that means they can't be in the studio 24/7. And so I think even if there was an optimal time, how does that get translated to all the different people who should consider being part of this profession and this world? And that's one of the reasons I was like, let's keep the studios open 24/7, because we don't know the lives that people are living while they're in school. And I do think some data-based analysis it could be groundbreaking. I don't know, like the new NAB, which is the National Accreditation Board for Architecture Schools, we just went through our accreditation cycle, or we're in the midst of it. And there's some different ways that they've shifted, how they're looking at work. And I think there is a bit more flexibility, and I hope that's in response. And I believe it's in response to how do we open up this practice?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if I answered
your question. I think, yeah, you did totally agree. And I wasn't advocating for like, you know, let's find the science and like create restrictions, but more like providing. Like
everybody eats the same meal. Everybody does 2 hours of exercise, and then you think about architecture. Then you go.
And I can tell, you can tell.
That's a really interesting study.
Yeah. more so, I'm thinking like, you know, just like any other classes, like you provide approaches to design, approaches to form finding, ultimately the student decides what works for them and what doesn't. But I think what I was getting at more is like integrating it into somehow the craft of being a placemaker, being a creator. If a component of that education, like, you know, all of our students take ethics, you know, like that is as a component of the education. So I'm wondering, is there some kind of component that approaches the creative mind in a more kind of academic setting as just like a course or something that like just addresses these things. So at least it's addressed, and there's not this like mythology that people just kind of arbitrarily are trying to live up to or trying to be like, never mind. I won't say anyone's name, but yeah, trying to be like I've been saying this like in a few conversations and in some reviews, but I guess not trying to be Howard Roark.
Yeah, the Roarkian model. I think our industry is this beautiful hybrid between the creative process and the rational world. My background, I was a set designer, so placemaking is really compelling to me. I think there's a lot of ways you can do it. But one of the things I did when I was doing a theater degree, it was one of my majors in undergrad, we had to take a class called the creative process. It was full of like people in the art side of the university, but also all the football players took it because it was an easy class. And it was really great readings. I'm such a nerd. I was always like getting as deep as I possibly could, but I think it actually has had a huge impact on me. And one of the things I'm talking, we have three new majors in the School of Architecture: design, computation, sustainability, and construction management. But that's paired with ACSMA, Applied Computer Science, Media Arts, and Interior Design. And, you know, I think sometimes when you're 18, you don't necessarily know where you want to go. And so how do you create sort of a baseline for anybody who wants to engage with placemaking or making experiences and the world a better place? So I think we oftentimes, at least in undergrad, get students who come from high school, which is much more a survey of a bunch of information. And as we start to get more specific and push creativity and push, I'd say, design thinking, what are the shared resources and shared communication tools that we all have to share and get buy-in on our ideas? But it's definitely like a class that at least the chairs in our school are thinking about.
Nice.
Because I think there is a capacity to like, but I hadn't really thought of it in terms of like, how do you use your body and your sleep and like your human beingness in that? And I think that's really imperative.
I think so. I mean, I know I don't, some of the things I do to get myself to produce the word count I need to do are probably not the healthiest, but you know, to get the job done. And it's not even anything about sleep deprivation. It's just in how I think everyone has their inner voice, but it's just how I get myself to do the work. And perhaps it's fine, perhaps it's not.
Well, I think also that giving yourself that space to reflect, is this fine? Is this, or is this just a slapstick version of something that I think I should be doing, or I think this is what I need to do. Like, that's where I think the 2 a.m. for me is like, oh, actually I never needed the 2 a.m. even though I thought it was my magic time. I still probably need my like weird dubstep Coco Rosie remix to get me like going.
I probably shouldn't have
admitted that to the general public. That's what my like magic playlist is.
I listen to dubstep all the time in studio. There's something about, which, and I have not listened to it in for years, but there's something about dubstep that just like,
I know,
got me
like
in like
wires
the
you.
Mode. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to your point, like there, I forgot what you just said, but this is what my response was going to be, is that, you know, with writing, oh yeah, you said time for reflection. And like, this is something I've been reflecting on for several years, because you read all of the great writers, like you read Hemingway or James Baldwin or Flannery O'Connor, and the rhetoric, and I mean, and I'm talking about reading their words about the craft of writing or about writing, and the, like Hemingway said, you know, you sit down at the typewriter and you bleed, and Flannery O'Connor's like, you want to be a writer? Well, then just go write, you know, like, why are you asking me about it? And like, and so like there is this, but then you also, you know, and more contemporary writers kind of get along these lines, like it starts to become more reasonable. It's not so romanticized, the struggling tortured artist. And I think that's kind of what I'm getting at, is like, I feel like the prevailing rhetoric and architecture is the one that we all are aware of, which is the harried worker. And there's more ways to look at it as you put it. I am curious, after this we'll get to the jury, because my assumption is always like, oh, everyone knows you as well as I do that are going to listen to this. But one thing I did not know about you was that you did like a theater degree. So maybe could you talk a bit about like kind of where you started and how you ended up where you are today?
Yeah. I grew up in a few places. I grew up between San Francisco, Los Angeles, and London. So I moved around a bit growing up. And then I was the team captain of a robotics team in high school, and thought that maybe I'd want to do a 2-3 architecture and engineering, or a liberal arts degree and an engineering degree between Middlebury and Dartmouth. And I got to Middlebury from LA, which is, I don't know if you could have a more different education or space. Like, Vermont and Los Angeles are different. I ended up not being able to get into a class that I wanted to, so I randomly took a set design class. And one of the things that I fell in love with was this ability to read stories and create worlds and then get to see people behave and live in them. And so you often start with like a play and you think about the users, who they are, and how the actors embody them, and how do you enhance their performance, and how do you create another character through the set or through the lighting, and through the art direction. It wasn't something I was expecting to love, but I also was terrified of architecture because I'm from a family of architects, or an architectural family, and knew that it would be really hard for me to figure out who I was with those big shadows. And maybe I think creating theater with a community and creating buildings and places with a band of architects and engineers and contractors and the communities that, but I did directing and design in undergrad, and I have a focus in women's and gender studies, and cool. Was Feminist of the Year. My boyfriend at the time wrote a song about it. So you're on Spotify.
Cool.
Then I moved to New York after I graduated, and I had a theater company with my friends, and I did set design at night and worked in nonprofits during the day. But it took me a while to realize, like, why would I create fake worlds for only specific people when I could really impact the built world and create places that people get to inhabit, not just in their imaginations, but in reality. And so I think I take a lot of those tools with me. And then I worked in construction. I was a project engineer. And then I went to graduate school in architecture at Cornell. And even when I was applying to architecture school, my professors in theater and my bosses in construction were like, what are you doing? Why would you do that to yourself? One of my bosses in the construction company I worked for, he was a reformed architect. So he would slide me some readings every week, but also be like, are you sure? Are you sure? And then I think, like, for me, I worked professionally. I got to work on a lot of really amazing projects in different places in the world. One of the things that I think maybe started pushing me into the idea of education was working on schools. I worked in the education studio, and then I started a firm with my partner, Stephen Klipp. So we're Gensler Klipp.
Nice.
And started teaching to also make sure I saw other human beings. Because it's also been something I'd been curious about for a really long time, and I fell in love with it. I think being able to help people find their voices and to help people find the best in themselves is the coolest thing anybody could really do. But I think it's almost like you'd find it as a designer. It's like, how do you open up possibilities for people?
That's a great,
I don't know if that's a clear background, but
it is. I just learned a lot about you too. I mean, I'm interested, like, what drew you? I know you kind of said, you were interested in teaching, but what specifically did you drew you to education, and now you're an administrator. And are you teaching as well, or are you just administrator?
Yeah, I'm teaching. Also, I'm teaching a degree project with a colleague of mine, Erin Wright, who's also a really amazing painter. Look her work up. She's
amazing. Yeah, it is. I've seen her work, and it's I still can't believe that it's actually her work is actually done with the human hand and not like.
I know, it's mind blowing.
Yeah, but what drew you to academia? I know you just kind of told us with the cultivating the young mind or helping people find their voice, but there had to be more to it before you even realized that was a part of it that drew you to it.
Yeah, I honestly, it wasn't as intentional as I think it may be for other people. I started teaching at Santa Monica College in the evenings. And so it was something that I was curious about. I talked to the incredible leadership team there. And I remember calling my mom after my interview and being like, can you believe it? I get to like teach. And then just designing how other people's minds can move through the ideas and how they gain new skills has been, I think it's actually really similar to architecture. You have to be really future-like thinking. I think we're all futurist. And so how do you pace a class? How do you sort of engage with ideas? How do you get people at different levels? I think with community colleges, there's a lot of people coming from really diverse backgrounds. I mean, in terms of like their work experience, their life experiences, what kind of time they can give, and making sure that everybody there gains something from the class. Yeah. And I think when you're an educator, you're really, at least for me, it's a conversation on like, how do we create the best environment for everybody here to learn and grow and find the best versions of themselves? And for some students, that means getting out of the way. For some students, that means like, hey, let's like work through this together. For some, it's like making sure they have the proper constraints. And like that first class, like I'm still... like one of the students from that class was the first intern I ever hired. Like, nice. I've gotten to see him grow through, university and now grad school. And it's a really incredible experience to not just see the work that happens in their class, but the lives that the students get to live after and like feel like I'm part of their story, but also rooting for them. Like, as they take on these new challenges, and that if I could impart any wisdom to the students that I've gotten to work with, it's just like, you have all the skills. It's just about how do we make sure you get excited enough to keep going. I think for me, education is about inspiring people to find their own voice and their own skills. I think fear is really short-sighted, and you know, you can get through the class, but then what happens? And so if any of my students still hear a little like version of my voice in their ear, hopefully it's a one like that's saying like, you can do this, keep going, work through it. Like, don't let the roadblocks stop you, because I think inherently our profession will have roadblocks.
Right.
There's like all of these moments that are going to feel like they're the end of something, but they're just, you know, you have to sort of change your approach. But I think it's the same with licensure. Like, if you're taking all your exams and you fail one, don't give up. Keep going. Right. You've gone this far.
Yeah.
I kind of went off on a tangent.
No,
motivational speaker for a second.
No, I mean, well, you do motivate a lot of students. I think you've heard that directly from students. And I know I've heard that. Both like, you know, students telling me to my face and students just talking about it, and they don't know that I can hear them talking about you. So yeah. So I think everything you're saying is totally spot on. There is a great desire for mentorship, and architecture really does seem like one of those fields that lends itself specifically to mentorship. I always think about the apprentice, you know, the mentor apprentice relationship. And not every profession, I think, has that part as part of its culture or history. And there really is, I think there is, as you were noting, an aptitude to, like, obviously not by default, everyone in architecture is not just a remarkable mentor, you know,
yeah,
or trying to uplift people or encourage people. And hopefully, I hope everyone can find someone to encourage them and someone to mentor them and someone to, I think the best example for people who have been listening to the podcast is Rawson, who's been like my mentor since I was like, I don't know, like my second year at Woodbury, like a second year. And now I'm like, you know, I've been graduated all these years and stuff. And like, he still helps me and guides me and with writing and thinking and all these types of things.
And I think like you almost need to create like a tapestry of mentors. Like I still have totally. So many mentors I reach out for different things. And I think there's also this idea that there's just going to be this one person who's going to advocate for you and push you. But I think thinking about it as like, how are you collecting a support system as you move through your career? And almost like, I don't know, maybe this is, I don't know why this example, like what are like the Power Rangers of your, your mentorship group? I never watched the Power Rangers, but I just feel like this group or Avengers or whatever sort of like superheroes you have that you can look up to who can help you fight different battles.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, I definitely have, for a while, I somehow thought, I mean, I guess exactly to your point, like I was that, and I embodied exactly what you just said when I was just graduating is like, I thought that there was going to be a singular person who, I don't know why, maybe it was from like all the Renaissance books I was reading or something. I thought there was going to be.
That's a narrative that comes up. Like throughout, and like I think I was looking for that one person too, but I found so many like amazing mentors in different ways. Like there's somebody who I reach out to if I'm struggling with a contract. There's somebody I reach out to, you know, if like I need a detail for a ballet bar, you know, but that's just not. And there's like life mentors, you know, they might not even be in this profession or, you know, and so, and my peers. And that's why, like, you know, there's a few rules I give to first years. I don't think they usually listen. It's like, try not to make out with anybody too soon. Like, you guys are going to be together for 5 years and then for the rest of your lives. But also be supportive and kind to each other. Like, you are a community. We are a community. Let's continue to build it together.
Yeah, 100%.
Because, 100%. Like, yeah, it's not... I think knowing who to ask for what is a thing that you gain through time. And I think it's okay if you're coming out of college and you haven't found your mentor or you haven't found the mentor you think you should find, because you probably have a bunch of like people rooting for you in different ways.
Yeah. 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 I love the note about peers, because especially recently, I guess always, even in school, but yeah, I guess recently I just feel like there are people who I consider my peers, but who I also like learn a lot from, you know, like there's just an area or like you and I talk, like I learn a lot from you about tons of things. Like I was just talking to Kevin, I'd learn a ton from him. And I mean, it was not always it wasn't always that way. I don't know if it's like where this kind of generation is in our career trajectory that's we've all kind of gone our different paths and really focused on something. So I'm like, okay, you know, I'm thinking this, I really need to talk to Erin about that. Like she's going to be the one to know about this. I haven't spent any time, you know, I haven't spent the last 10 years thinking about this particular thing, you know?
Yeah. And it's like, I know like my grandfather, his like main, one of his favorite things was this Rolodex, and we don't have that anymore. Like, but it's, we have like on our cell phone, every phone number we could need maybe. And so being able to sort of think about you're learning from this community. Like I learned from the students. There was one student who did this, like such a beautiful party model out of donuts. And I just am still so jealous of that. It was just, so good. I think like I'm learning from the students, that I'm learning from my peers. I have these amazing older mentors in age or in experience. Yeah, and it's not just one person for me to sort of get me through this. And then, you know, and I'm building it. It's like, you know, you think about, we're architects. We always think about buildings. You think about like the foundation and then where does it go from there? It's not like a building is made from a lot of different parts.
Yeah.
And with different people helping out.
100%. I was reading this book, it's called The Psychology of Money. Maybe you've seen it. It's kind of a new book.
Yeah, I've seen it, but I haven't read it.
I don't know actually if this point was in the book or if it was in another book, but essentially it is the concept of compound interest. Now I'm starting to think it wasn't in the Psychology of Money book. It's just that the Psychology of Money book talked about compound interest, but then I read something somewhere else where the person was saying that like relationships also worked in a compound manner, that like the more people you get to know, the more you know someone, the more you invest in time in them, that investment of time and relationship and giving or whatever it is with that person or multiple people has a compound return to you over time. And I think that I've for sure seen that in architecture. You know, at first it was like it was Elizabeth Timmy telling someone at Lehrer Architects, like, hey, you know, talk to Sean. And it was like another colleague of mine because we were in the summer studio. And then that happened. And I met someone there. And then I did, you know, and then through there I met someone else. And then, you know, before you know it, with an architect, you know all these people. And then you're just getting a call like, hey, this opening's happening. Sean, can you chat with us? But I like how you put it, the tapestry of mentors. I like that. So to some of these points, I want to talk about the jury and review, traditional kind of review formats. What are your overall thoughts on just the format of mid and final reviews and just the whole notion of the jury in architecture school?
Yeah, one student was like, are the judges coming? And I'm like, they're not judges. They're not judges. I think architecture is an inherently public art. We constantly have our works displayed. People use them. People like have their opinions. I think it's important to be able to share your ideas publicly and get buy-in from communities. And I think that the jury reflects that. Public nature, it's really important for conversation to be productive and not just critical. There's nothing that makes me more upset than a conversation that is just not helpful. But I think like it can also open up some bigger ideas. And the conversations that happen collectively are so valuable. For the students who are not paying attention on other people's reviews, you get so much help and insight from how critics respond to your classmates as much as yours. And totally. Hopefully you get to be that to your classmates when faculty and jurors are not there. I like to talk to my students before a final review. I try and be really quiet during my students' reviews. They've talked to me all semester. And so this is their opportunity to hear about the project from somebody meeting it that moment and where their grades and the conversations that we have during our classes continue. And it's really helpful, I think, to see another perspective. And I think people are afraid of what they don't know or afraid of putting their ideas out there, but hopefully it's a really respectful, positive experience. I think when I started getting more comfortable with reviews is when I realized how amazing it is to be able to share your ideas with people you respect and admire and to get feedback from them. My master's thesis was a public bathroom, and I loved having these like incredible thinkers and educators and just very impressive people talk about what it's like to sit on a toilet. Like, it was so fun, but it also reminded me that like, A, it's a performance. I would really encourage students to sort of think about how they present work and what the story they're telling. It doesn't have to be like, this is my project. Like, use slam poetry, use music. Like, you have, like, I think maybe that's my like theater director side is like, it doesn't have to just be this one-to-one thing. but it's a skill that you're developing. And I love the idea that things are kind of shifting. Sometimes we have final reviews that are more gallery style. Sometimes we have like sort of a round robin or a few that are happening at the same time. So you get longer reviews, and they're more intimate. You're not necessarily like just sitting and hearing the feedback from each student, but engaging with different jurors. And I think there's space to explore different ways of having final reviews for studio. But I think it's really important to put the work out there and for the whole community to get to see it. That was one of the things that we really missed in the pandemic, although we had, you know, websites and other things to try to emulate these spaces. But this sort of happenstance of seeing somebody present work or talk about work that you might not have been exposed to the rest of the semester, it's a really incredible thing. And I think beyond that, I would encourage students to look at reviews at different schools. To sort of get out there, I think of Los Angeles as a place, you know, Los Angeles has four, and if you get a little bit outside, more really incredible school. And to think of the whole city as an asset. Beyond that, we also have A+D and all these really incredible organizations and museums. But to get out there, especially during your breaks, and to see what's happening, not just on the campus that you're at, but sort of what is happening in the national and global ideas across campuses.
That's really good. And the different formats, I think, are interesting too, like the gallery format. My final review was kind of like a hybrid traditional / gallery format, which I appreciated. It helped me get over some of the nerves I had those years back. I'm curious, if we're thinking traditionally of the jury, what makes a good juror? And the reason I'm asking you that is for two reasons. I know that a lot of people, including myself, when I first went on a jury, feel that because their experience when they were a student was to really just get pummeled and really get kind of harshly critiqued. And for a lot of people, I don't think anything really good was told to them about what they did, that people kind of think that that's the expectation, that you're supposed to kind of just critique and maybe not even be mean-spirited, but it's just like that's the goal, is to like find what's wrong with something. So the reason I'm asking is so that perhaps people who sit on juries, or maybe, you know, what makes a good juror, but also for students to hear what a good juror is, so that when one that's not good is there, you can just kind of say, okay, this person's just not a good juror, and I don't have to get bent out of shape if they didn't like my thing or whatever. And I mean, I know there's a whole discussion of like the point is not for someone to like or dislike your work anyway, but what do you think makes a good juror?
I think that's a really good question. And I'm only one person. So yeah, for me, I think it's really important to listen to the students, to sort of like engage with what they're bringing to the table, no matter where they are. I think productive feedback, what can they take on as they move through their academic career and beyond, is always helpful. I think sort of looking at the material that's there and talking about, and I think it's different at different moments of your education. Like the first year, you want to sort of engage with like aperture and lightness and movement and some of the more fundamental parts of your education. And then as you get more complex, like if you're talking about an egress plans, like how does somebody move through this? How does somebody, I don't know why egress is so part of my brain right now. I apologize.
Egress is important. Like, egress is important.
Don't kill people. right. But I think there's like more specific supportive comments in those, but also how does it feel? What is it like to the public? But it's hard to give a general advice, but one of the things that I've been thinking about, and literally was just in a meeting earlier about, is like, do we create like a set of expectations for people who are coming to be jurors? Because I think you're right. It's not like what we were, what we experienced. We don't want it to be like that. We want it to be a productive space or like for me in studios now, if I'm coordinating a studio, I have always the first page of the syllabus after just like the basic generic catalog description is a studio manifesto. It's like, how do you set the tone for what we want to do? I think there's some professors are looking for different things from their jurors than others. But I think it's like getting some initial feedback from somebody who hasn't been totally embedded in the project, like the professor or the student, is really valuable. But also a connection to the community at large is really invaluable to their students, to get exposure to different ideas and thinkers beyond just who we can hire as faculty.
Nice, nice. Yeah, what you said there made me think of when I was doing my MFA, before we went to the, because we all had to submit our work, like a short story that was going to be part of a workshop that we were in, but there were very, very strict instructions about like how to behave when giving feedback to other people, how to receive feedback. Essentially what you're saying, it was just very clear that this is like, they're really serious about what the tone of the workshop was going to be, what it was going to be like to give and receive feedback, you know, so even to the level of detail of saying, like, you know, start with like X amount of things that are working and start with X amount of things that aren't working. And then like when you're receiving feedback, you receive it in silence, you know, don't say anything, don't try to argue, you know, and then you'll have your time to speak and things like that. But I just found that I went into it feeling relative, and it was my first time kind of in a workshop of the setting, but feeling relatively like I knew what to expect and the way it was, and even the instructor abided by those same exact guidelines that all those students did. So I like that, because then when I think of an architecture review, it's kind of like, yeah, just, can you just come be in the review, and you just kind of come and sit there, and everyone has their idea of like kind of what it should be like and it shouldn't be like, and that's fair, like you were saying, but it perhaps establishing some kind of ethics, code of ethics or whatever, that the person who's going to come and participate, you know, agrees to, that could be a way to promote the experience of the students and the other jurors. And yeah.
And I think what, especially when you teach foundationals, like the students become the jurors. So if we set that expectation, they're practicing it, engaging with like, how do you communicate about ideas and then take it to the next level. I think for me, it's review season. I was on reviews at like six different schools, and each one had a really different tone, all hoping to support their students and be productive. But as each studio is set up in really different ways, it takes also a little while for jurors to get comfortable. I know people have different organizations to how they run their reviews, but I think the more I think about it, the more positive an experience it could be if you get sort of like a ground rules, even if it's a few lines, like, welcome, this is our declaration.
Yeah. Yeah. No, totally. I mean, I wasn't on as many reviews as you, but I was on a few. and I have noticed like an overall change in tone than like, you know, before, which is nice to see and is encouraging. Yeah, I think, I mean, we're over an hour now here. I know we can keep going.
Sorry, guys.
we can keep going. But I think we talked about a lot of really cool ideas, and yeah, I was really interested in just talking with you about, obviously I'm front of frame these discussions is talking about place, and I was excited to talk, and I think that we got to talk about this. To talk to you about how do you teach someone to be a placemaker, you know, like what art and what goes into, and even just the art of teaching, you know, of like you talked about molding the mind and helping someone find their voice, and or you said designing the mind. I think you said that, but I know we're using figures of speech, but yeah, what do you want to leave the audience with? Like, where can people find you, follow you online? What, any thoughts you want to leave us with?
Yeah, I'm a little bit of a shy. I'm a little bit shy, so I'm not necessarily on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram, LinkedIn, the normal things. Reach out to me with my school email, or if you are curious about teaching or architecting. I think if you're curious about architecture, if you feel like it's something that you want to do, and you're maybe like checking out this podcast because you have a little bit of an architectural itch, I think community colleges are a really amazing place to start to see, or there are summer programs at amazing schools across the country, across the world. We need more incredible people in this profession. If you feel like you're looking for a way to contribute to the world, it's a really rewarding thing, but I think it needs to be driven by you. So I think education can meet you there, but at the end of the day, it's your journey. This is not a one-size-fits-all profession. I think people can find themselves in many different ways, and the spaces that we create are reflections of the people who make them and the experiences they have had. I think it's also not too late to be an architect. A lot of the things in my life that I didn't think were going towards architecture have made me a better architect and thinker, educator. And so also, if you're an architect, get into your hobbies and your weird stuff and let that influence your architecture. And if you're an architect who's like kind of in like a questioning architecture, which I think we all do often, I'd encourage you to think about teaching and giving back to the next generation. It was really fun hanging out with you. And I feel like we always have like a bit of a giggle fest when we chat.
Oh, totally.
But this was really fun.
Thank you, Aaron. It was great.
Thank you.